You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and wonderful mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and I want credit for this lovely weather because, you see, it happens every year. I put my summer clothes away, get my winter clothes out, and it turns nice.
And you're going to get credit for a whole lot more today.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, we'll see as we go on, as we are talking with our guest today, who is Dr. David Simon, MD. He's the pioneer in the mind-body medicine movement. His views on the relationship between emotional and physical health were shaped while studying shamanism as an anthropology student. Between his anthropology and medical studies, David immersed himself in meditation, yoga, and holistic healing practices. As a board-certified neurologist, he brings a unique perspective to the relationship between mind, emotions, and health. David is the driving force behind the Chopra Center's flagship programs and workshops and has written a number of award-winning books on health, spirituality, and conscious living that have been translated into more than 25 languages.
Wow.
And today we're talking with Dr. Simon about Free to Love, Free to Heal. Heal your body by healing your emotions. Welcome to Writer's Voices.
Pleasure to be here with you.
So do you like us to call you Dr. Simon or David, or do you have a preference?
You can call me David.
Okay. Well, David, tell us a little bit about how you came to write this particular book.
This is, in many ways, a culmination of my many decades as a doctor. And what I've come to realize is that people come into a doctor's office with a complaint. It's almost like a ticket that gets them in the door. And, you know, conventional medical approaches generally are focused on relieving symptoms, but what I've discovered is that if we can create enough safety for a person and the attention and time that they need, almost always underlying every symptom is a story, and that story is almost always a love story, and that love story is almost always a sad love story, and that if we can help people to identify and begin to tell that story, then that's really the beginning of healing and transformation.
Now, how does this book differ from books you've written in the past?
I think that this is the most authentic book that I've written, in that although, you know, most of my previous books have woven a lot of East-West philosophy, this I think transcends culture and transcends philosophy and really goes to the heart of healing. And in that way, it doesn't have the assumptions that many of my previous books have had, assumptions that people understand a certain philosophy or certain worldview. And it also provides a very well-proven pathway to healing. And so this book is actually, in many ways, derived from a course that I've been teaching for a number of years here at the Chopra Center, where people who come with a whole host of both psychological and physical challenges, you know, have participated in this intensive clearing workshop. And as a result of that, there's been really substantial shifts both in their physical and psychological well-being. So it's a proven pathway. I think it gets to the heart of suffering and offers a clear path out of that.
Now, I found it very interesting, David, that you talk about alternative medicine, but you have a somewhat different definition of alternative medicine than what we might normally think.
Yeah, I mean, to be truthful, I think that most alternative medicine is just bad psychotherapy.
Okay.
So how do you define alternative medicine?
Well, you know, that's a little too disparaging. I mean, no, alternative medicine is something that we in the West call anything that isn't taught in a medical school. So that includes chiropractic and naturopathy and acupuncture and herbal medicine, and you know, they all have some role to play. But my experience is that often alternative medical practitioners are still coming from a very allopathic model. It's just that rather than providing a pharmaceutical, they'll stick a needle in an acupressure point, or they'll prescribe an herb, or they'll tell someone to take the mercury fillings out of their mouth. But it's still this model of, you know, someone on the outside is going to fix you on the inside. And, you know, certainly here at the center, we see people who have been through, you know, an amazing, turbulent journey, often very expensive, of going from one type of doctor to another, seeking relief. And, of course, you know, like the old blind men and the elephant, you know, if you're an acupuncturist, you'll tend to think that all problems are due to some challenges in chi and a blockage in a meridian, so you'll treat it that way. If you're, you know, if you're an herbalist, everything is to be treated with an herbal remedy. If you're a nutritionist, it's always due to some deficiency in diet. If you're a chiropractor, it's due to a subluxation. And my experience is that very seldom do any doctors, either conventional medical doctors or all the alternative doctors, really ask the deeper questions about what's the life story that's giving rise to this imbalance, and how can we start writing a new, more compelling, more conscious chapter in that story, so that, you know, it's almost as if everybody takes their pound of flesh. I see it every day. People come to me with, you know, irritable bowel syndrome or chronic pain or low levels of depression, and so they've gone to their medical doctor, and, you know, within 5 minutes they're getting a prescription. It may not work, so then they'll go to their chiropractor and they go through a series of adjustments, and it's still not really getting to the core. Then they'll go to an acupuncturist, then they'll have a series of acupuncture treatments, then they'll go to the holistic dentist, and they'll be told that it's because they have too many mercury amalgam fillings. And one after another, they'll go through this pathway, and then they'll finally come, and I'll start asking them stories about their life and find out that, you know, there are some really, really traumatic things that have happened, you know, child abuse or, you know, really disappointing relationships, or just this pervasive sense of unworthiness. And, you know, when we start to explore those areas, it's often what leads to a dramatic shift in their level of energy and vitality and their access to healing forces. And when I ask them, has anyone, you know, have you ever told anyone this before? They'll say, no, no one's ever asked me. There's never been any time. So I think that I think this peace, this understanding that we are multidimensional beings, that not only do we have bodies made out of molecules, but we have hearts and souls and minds and experiences and relationships, and that in order to really affect genuine, lasting transformation and healing, we have to get out of our constricted worldview and see people and see ourselves as multidimensional beings.
Now, there certainly are situations, and I think in your book you make it clear that there are times when pharmaceuticals or surgery or whatever are definitely called for.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, certainly in terms of acute illness, there's nothing that really rivals modern medicine. You know, if you have a pneumonia with a bacteria, the antibiotics that are available today will save people's lives who in any previous generation would have died. There's, you know, I think there's clearly a role for chemotherapy in people with various types of cancer, which has absolutely improved survival and increased the chances of cure. You know, if you're in a traumatic accident, there's nothing like modern, both diagnostic and therapeutic interventions to save people's lives. And so there's clearly a role. I mean, to me, holistic doesn't mean excluding anything. It actually means embracing all these tools, but using the appropriate tool for the right job, but also then looking at a deeper level. So I think in the book I give a number of examples. These are real stories that I've heard of people who on the surface you would not think this was a mind-body or emotional issue. You know, there's a paper published in one of the one of the medical journals a year or so ago, where they looked at people admitted to hospital and asked the question, you know, was there a mind-body story? And in something like 80-plus percent, there was a very accessible mind-body story right under the surface. So an example that they gave was of an elderly lady who came into the hospital with a hip fracture. And normally we wouldn't think that a hip fracture is an emotional story. But when you took a little time to understand this lady, what came out was that after, I don't know, 50 years of marriage, her husband died. And for the first time in decades, she was sleeping alone, and she couldn't sleep. She couldn't get to sleep. So she got a prescription from her family doctor for some Ambien, and that wasn't enough, so she started drinking, you know, a few glasses of sherry before bed. And one evening she got up to go to the bathroom. She was still a little tipsy from the medicine and from the wine, and she fell and broke her hip. And so to send this lady back with a pinned hip but not to start addressing some of the social loneliness that she was experiencing, you know, would have not really been a healing experience. And so, you know, it's my experience that almost every story, you know, whether or not it's high blood pressure, a heart attack, cancer, you know, a traumatic injury, there's usually some love story underneath the surface, and people are often embarrassed to talk about it, or there's not the opportunity. But if you address it, then you can really go to the heart of the health challenge and really begin to activate a deeper level of a healing response.
Is this what your center does then when people come to the center? That's what you focus on?
We have a very, you know, our mindset is, how can we help you? And, you know, if someone is primarily concerned with some physical symptom, then we'll try to find the best possible intervention that will help to relieve that physical symptom. If someone is aware that there's a more emotional concern, then we'll deal with it at that level. So, you know, we trust the process of healing, and our main approach here at the Chopra Center is to create this very safe, nurturing, open-hearted, open-minded environment. And then it seems as if the nature of human physiology, probably of all biology, is that it wants to establish balance, it wants to establish equilibrium, it wants to release things that it's carrying, you know, the physiology wants to release something that it's carrying from the past that's not serving, and begin to ingest or open up to experiences that are nurturing. And so that's the approach we take. If someone has a breast lump, you know, at the beginning at least, it's not the time to talk about how your marriage has been unfulfilling. It's the time to take the lump out, get a diagnosis, and chart a course of healing. Mm-hmm. But somewhere along the way, we'll start looking at other issues at the appropriate time when the person is really ready to integrate that information.
Once somebody has cancer, do you think you really can heal it through this type of work, through emotional healing?
I think it's one part of it. I wouldn't, you know, I mean, we take care of a lot of people with cancer, including people who have avoided Western conventional care, and so we see that most often when the imbalance has gotten to the level of a malignancy, thinking happy thoughts is not going to cure you of cancer. It's an important component, but we also strongly take advantage of all the modalities that have been shown to treat the disease and remove the underlying cause. So, again, you know, our mindset of holistic doesn't mean that you avoid appropriate conventional medical care. You bring it in, but then you also complement it with approaches on multiple other levels, you know, be it nutritional, meditation, exercise, supplements, but always looking at what's the message, what's the meaning, what's the story that is woven around this illness, and how do we start writing a more compelling chapter in the next chapter in this story.
So you're treating the whole person angle.
Our goal is to reestablish integration between the various levels mm-hmm. of an individual. You know, we tend to fragment parts of ourselves. We're
yes.
a job that we don't like, so we kind of wall it off because we need to pay our mortgage. We're in a relationship that's not nourishing, and we tend to bear with it because we don't want to disrupt our kids' lives. You know, we tend to fulfill those unmet love needs by eating too much or eating junk food or smoking or drinking or doing drugs or, you know, other behaviors that give us temporary relief but don't really provide us deeper levels of nourishment. So we see our role as helping people get more clarity so that moving forward they can make choices that are life-supporting rather than are life-damaging.
Now, in the 15 years since you and Deepak Chopra established the Chopra Center, have you seen an increase in the number of people seeking out holistic medical treatment?
Definitely. You know, I think at the beginning we were kind of just coyotes calling in the night, but you don't have to look very far to see that at least in lip service is increasingly being paid to this mind, body, spirit, you know, component. I mean, I don't know if it's happening where you are, but you know, in San Diego, you know,
we're in Fairfield, Iowa, so
multiple
yes.
times a day, you know, there are advertisements on Kaiser, you know, Kaiser Healthcare, how it's all about stress and laughter and you know, eating healthier and exercising, and so you know, all the things that were kind of laughed at, you know, a couple decades ago, are you know now almost considered obvious or. Necessary. So there's a tremendous increasing interest. Not only, you know, I mean, clearly the medical establishment is always a little bit slow to pick up on things, but you know, every year Deepak and I give a talk at Harvard Medical School to about 500 internal medicine people on the value of mind-body medicine. You know, communities are very interested. Just yesterday I had a meeting with one of the major orthopedic groups in San Diego who are asking if we can bring yoga and meditation into their treatment protocol because they realize that surgery is often not the answer. So conversations, we're hearing conversations now that, you know, were almost unimaginable, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
It does seem like the physicians are, more and more physicians are turning to a more holistic approach.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it doesn't mean rejecting the things that we know are valuable in conventional medicine, but any honest doctor would say that they see many patients every day that they know that their problems are, you know, at the very least stress-related and, you know, often at a deeper level. And the problem, you know, the way healthcare is structured right now, you know, we have the sickest healthcare system probably on the planet, is that given the amount of time that a doctor has with a patient, it just makes sense that you'll write a prescription for insomnia rather than talk about what's keeping them awake at night.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you'll send them somewhere for their chronic pain, a physical therapist, rather than talking about, you know, what's that pain trying to tell you. But I think that nobody's satisfied with the current healthcare system and you know, either because the community at large will demand it or physicians will just get so tired of acting as, you know, disease technologists that, you know, sometime in the next generation we'll see a shift, hopefully.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Dr. David Simon, MD, the author of Free to Love, Free to Heal, Heal Your Body by Healing Your Emotions. David, can you share a story of emotional healing that had a profound impact on you?
Sure. I see it every day. I saw a lady just last week. A terrible story. I mean, it's like let me give you some signs, then I'll tell you the story.
Okay.
Because I think it's so important. There was just a paper published a few months ago in the journal Psychosomatics, which is a highly reputable peer-reviewed medical journal. They looked at people who were admitted to hospital with an autoimmune disease. So, do you know what an autoimmune disease is? It's a disease where the immune system has gotten so confused that instead of doing its job of fighting off bacteria or viruses or cancer, it turns against your own body.
Mm-hmm.
So common autoimmune diseases are things like rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis. So they looked at this group of people, about 500 people who were admitted to the hospital, and they evaluated what their lives were like growing up. And they identified what they called adverse childhood experiences. there were seven of them that they categorized. So one was being subjected to emotional abuse as a child. Second was being subjected to physical abuse as a child. Third was being subjected to sexual abuse as a child. The fourth was being repeatedly subjected to violence among your caregivers, you know, your parents fighting all the time or screaming or threatening each other. The fifth was alcoholism or drug abuse in the family. The sixth was mental illness in the family. And the seventh was a very conflicted divorce when you were, as a child. So first of all, it turned out that, you know, a phenomenal number of people in general have one or more of these seven adverse childhood episodes. I think something like 35% to 40% of people will have one of those, and probably in the next generation it'll be over half, since half of marriages are ending in divorce these days. What they found was that for every one of these adverse childhood episodes, you had a 20% increased risk of developing an autoimmune disease decades later in as an adult. So it's this really profound and sad story that carrying this emotional pain with us without an opportunity to release it really will eventually translate not only to psychological distress but even into physical illness. So I just can think of an example that I heard last week, and these are terrible stories. A woman's father was in Vietnam and came back, and she was about 5 or 6 at the time that he came back, and promptly began to sexually molest her. So he would climb in bed with her and rub up against her, and when or so later, he would actually have sexual intercourse with her, and she was scared out of her mind, and the mother, you know, paid no attention, and it had a profoundly negative effect on her. Then, a few years later, when she was about 11, just before she went through puberty, she remembers it because as soon as she actually became a woman, he stopped doing it to her. It was a very kind of sad, strange, sick situation. But when she was, just before she went into puberty, her father took her to his garage where he did car repairs, and two burglars came in and wanted the combination to the safe, and the father wouldn't give it to him. So they took the little girl, who was 11, put her on the ground, held a gun to her head, and said, "If you don't tell us the combination, we'll blow her brains out." And the father said, "Go ahead, she doesn't mean anything to me." And so they didn't do it, but you can only imagine what those experiences
have had in this life.
And so she had just a series of illnesses. She had, you know, subtle illnesses like irritable bowel syndrome. She had chronic depression, chronic anxiety, insomnia, and then finally got breast cancer when she was about 55. And throughout all the treatment that she had for this illness, she never told the story to anybody. And finally, she, you know, in this context, she was at the point where she just couldn't hold it in anymore. And, you know, went through a tremendous emotional cathartic release of telling this story. And, you know, in the safety and love of our center, you know, we reassured her that although as an adult she may look back and thought she should have done things differently, it's almost impossible for children to set those boundaries, particularly when both parents are part of the conspiracy. And you could just see in every level of her being that there was a healing and a transformation taking place. You know, she'll do fine with her breast cancer because it was caught in an early stage. I think that a lot of these other so-called psychosomatic or functional illnesses will dissipate. We could tell even by the time she left here that a lot of these challenges were already resolving themselves. So, you know, this may sound like an extreme story, but it's my experience that stories like this are not at all uncommon, and that people carry them with them their whole lives, and it affects every aspect of their life, their relationships, their emotional health, and even their physical health.
So what techniques do you use to get her to release that and deal with it?
Well, the actual process of, you know, our kind of emotional healing process is detailed in, you know, in the Free to Love book. I mean, it's almost a manual for what we do. So, you know, in Fairfield, you're, I'm sure, aware of Panchakarma, this system of physical detoxification that comes from Ayurveda. And there are these steps. You know, the idea is that when you have something undigested from your past, you store it in your physiology. The term for that in Sanskrit is as ama. And that ama, that toxicity, that leftover residue begins to interfere with the free flow of energy in the body. So we take a similar approach to what we call emotional ama, which means these emotional, distressing, boundary-violating, unmet need experiences, and that we store them in our emotional body, you know, in our hearts and our souls. And so there's five steps. The first is you prepare, and for our courses, we teach everyone meditation to help them quiet their minds. We take them through what we call heart-opening yoga poses to just kind of get connected to the sensations in their body. So there's a preparation phase. Then there's an identification phase.
And in your book, you do show these poses, and you do give instructions on meditation as well.
Absolutely. You know, we recognizing that most people will not be able to come out to California and participate in this program. Mm-hmm. The book was written in the hope that it will at least get people started in this releasing process. So then we ask people to identify, and then we ask we get people to quiet down in meditation so that their conscious minds are not filtering so much, and then have them connect with their body, you know, their heart, and then ask questions such as, you know, identify an experience that you associate with emotional pain. And often people have, you know, many, many stories around that. So that the first thing to do is to try to figure it out. Like, what am I suppressing? What am I repressing? What am I carrying with me from the past? And, you know, it could be dramatic, like the one I just told, or it could be, you know, I just was in a bad marriage and my husband was alcoholic, and when he got drunk, he said mean things to me and it hurt me, but I wanted to stay with it. So we give people the opportunity to identify what they're carrying with them, both in terms of toxic stories and also toxic beliefs. Because, you know, one of the things that really hurts people and suppresses their health and their enthusiasm for life is, you know, if you're raised by caregivers who are not very healthy, and they give you messages like, you know, you're worthless, or you'll never amount to anything, or you're just a parasite, or you're fat, or you're stupid, or you're ugly, or whatever. And, you know, when we're kids, we don't have the filters up, particularly if it comes from someone that we're dependent upon or, you know, seeking love from. They can go pretty deep, and that misinformation can really strongly influence how we think about ourselves and our relationship to others.
Well, this is
so we ask people to identify what we call toxic stories and toxic traits.
Mm-hmm. David, this is the part where I said, when I said Mom was going to get some credit during the show. When I read that part, and I'm trying to identify toxic traits myself, I couldn't really identify any because she never said anything bad about me.
I never thought anything bad about you.
She never said anything negative like that. My mother, I don't think that way about myself at all.
Because you're reasonably healthy, and healthy souls tend to choose healthy families. And so, I mean, what's true is that everybody should be getting these messages from early on that you are lovable, that you are wonderful, that you are beautiful, that you have, you know, something to contribute to the world, that you deserve to be happy, that you deserve to have loving, nurturing relationships, that you deserve to make choices that bring about health and happiness. And so, you know, there's no other truth. You know, you look at any baby, you know, and you'd say, does that baby deserve to be happy? You'd say, of course that baby deserves to be happy. Does that baby deserve to be healthy? Of course. Does that baby deserve to be loved? Of course. Does that baby have something to contribute to the world when it grows up? Of course. So it's only because of all these distortions, you know, due to, you know, generation after generation of toxicity that people get this misinformation. But the problem as a child is that, you know, you don't know how to filter it out. I was at the county fair with my kids a couple months ago, and we were looking at these funny mirrors, you know, these mirrors that make you look really tall and skinny, or you know, make you look really wide and short, and realize that, you know, as children, we're looking into the mirrors of our caregivers, and if we get back a distorted image, it's difficult for a child to think that maybe there's something wrong with the mirror.
Yeah.
We think there's something wrong with me.
Sure.
And, you know, and it takes a while to separate out that distortion from what's true, and what's true is that every one of us deserves to be happy and healthy.
Now, is it possible to go too far the other way and where you always think that it's the mirror's fault and not yours?
Of course.
Yeah, there's a happy medium there, isn't there?
One of the principles in Enlightened Relationships, which is at the end of the book, is that I see all my relationships as mirrors of myself. So if I bring someone into my life, particularly if it's a pattern, you know, I always tend to attract a certain type of person into my life, then, you know, and then I think I'm going to fix it in that person, it almost always means that that person is mirroring back something about ourselves that we don't want to really see, so we project it outward. So, you know, we have to get clear on what is true, and that's not always so obvious.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're up to step two, which was identify, and then the third step?
Third step is to mobilize, and we mobilize by doing these very intimate revelations. So, you know, normally when we teach this course, we have, you know, 100 to 150 people taking it together, and we pair people up in these circles with people they don't know. We turn the lights really low, and, you know, by this time, there's a real sense of opening in everyone. And we have people tell each other their stories, and we teach the people who are listening to the stories a very specific way of responding, which is just basically listening with their full attention, their full, you know, their body language is demonstrating their attention, but they're not trying to solve the problem, they're not giving their own feedback, they're simply letting this, I almost see it as an emotional abscess drain, you know, if the body gets an infection and it's not strong enough to completely eliminate the infection, it does the next best thing, which is it walls off these little pockets of pus, but it still depletes the life energy of the organism, and ultimately you want that infection to be released in the surface so that it can scar without that festering wound. And I see that often people carry these emotional abscesses in a similar way, and that by revealing your story to somebody else who's listening with compassion, non-judgment, it's part of that mobilization process. I see it as part of that releasing of that toxicity. So that's the next step. And then the fourth step is what we call releasing. And what we tend to do at the center, and I encourage people to do it in the book, is we go down to the beach and we take over a beach and we have people, you know, maybe 5 yards apart, and they pick up rocks on the beach and they hold the rocks to their heart. It's a ritual, obviously. And while they're holding the rock to their heart, they close their eyes and they tell the story again. But this time, as they're telling the story, they're having the intention to separate the emotional pain from the story. So the story stays in their awareness as something that they've learned, but the pain goes into the rock. It's like they're charging up the rock, and when the rock is fully charged up, then they throw the rock into the ocean with a, you know, a strong verbal accompaniment. You know, they swear, they shout something, and the intention is to just let go of the pain because it's not serving them anymore. And they do that through their stories. We have, you know, usually people identify, you know, like about 7 different stories, and they go through this process. It takes an hour or so of releasing, and because of the preparation and the identification and the mobilization, they're really at that point ready to let go of that story. And often in that, there's a big release and a sense of freedom and a sense of unburdening and a declaration that they don't have to carry that anymore. And then that opens up to the fifth step, which is rejuvenation. And so then we spend, you know, a couple hours talking about envisioning a life that is worthy, a life that where their choices are in alignment with the deeper belief that we all deserve to be happy and we all deserve to have love, we all deserve to make choices that are life-supporting and health-promoting. And so, you know, in a sense, rather than just reading the script that we've been handed, we realize, hey, I can write the next screenplay for my life.
We're speaking with Dr. David Simon today, author of Free to Love, Free to Heal, and you're listening to Writer's Voices on KRUULP 100.1 FM in Fairfield, Iowa. David, sometimes in my observations of people around me, it seems like There are certainly people who have suppressed painful experiences in the past, but there's others that seem to almost dwell in them. How does?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, there's no question that in order to navigate the world of relationships, which is not an easy place for many people, we've all developed our own little control dramas. You know, if you ever read the old Carlos Castaneda books, you know, Don Juan says that there are four basic control dramas that human beings employ. One is being really nice. So, you know, you're so nice to everybody, and you hope that by being really nice, you'll get your needs met. Another is being nasty. So, you know, by being demanding and demeaning and controlling, so, you know, you hope that you'll get your needs met. Another is being poor me. You know, you're always the one who's kind of pathetic, and in a lot of ways, being pathetic has a lot of power. You know, I heard someone once say that every family is a tyranny ruled by its weakest member. So you can imagine, you know, like, you know, maybe, you know, it's your mother. You know, you say, let's go out for dinner tonight. You want to go to Italian? And the pathetic person says, oh, you know, the tomato sauce always gives me a heartburn. But, you know, wherever you want to go is fine. Okay, well, how about if we go to, you know, Indian food? Oh, you know, those spices, I just don't like how I feel. But wherever you go is fine. Everybody tries to figure out a way to get the person who's indulging in that poor me control drama to feel comfortable. So it can be quite a powerful way of manipulating. It just doesn't make anybody happy, including the person who's involved in it. So, you know, you can't change anybody who doesn't want to change. But if someone is struggling and recognizes that maybe if they did things differently, they could struggle less, then, you know, these are the kind of confrontations and conversations that may help people see that there's a better way to get our needs met than these old ways, which may have worked when we were a little kid, but usually don't work that well when we're adults. Mm.
Well, David, as you know, we talk to writers and we talk a lot about the writing process, and we've dealt with writing as itself as a healing, a form of healing, and you also talk about that in your book. That's one of the steps in, I believe, in the identification process.
Right.
You want to tell
we
us
do.
A little bit
I mean,
about
I,
that?
I think journaling is very powerful. I mean, really, for me, writing books is therapy. You know, and it's also so interesting once you start writing that it almost takes on a life of its own. That information starts to come from a deeper place and awareness that you might not even be conscious of at the time. And we also think that when you're dealing with painful experiences, there's something kind of magical about writing it out. You know, if you keep it inside yourself, there's often so much secrecy about emotional pain. Like, people are embarrassed to tell anybody that they're hurting because, you know, everybody's supposed to be strong and competent. But you keep it inside of you, and when you write it, it seems like it's not so much inside of you. It's almost like you download something from your hard drive to a floppy or a flash drive, and now you have more space on your hard drive to do something creative. So, and there are actually some scientific studies on the value of journaling. There are some studies that taught people with autoimmune, with asthma and with rheumatoid arthritis how to journal, and they actually found that over the course of time, the people who journal had less need for medication, less hospital visits. There's something quite powerful about writing things down. So whether or not it's as an author or as someone who's in a healing response, we encourage people to keep journals and to download their information so that there's a little bit of a separation of the charge.
Mom and I were talking about your book this morning when we were getting ready for the show, and her friend was there, and I mentioned this thing about, you know, writing down, writing your story, the painful things that happened, and her friend said, I've been doing that. I've done that over and over again. I've been doing that all my life. And she writes down when she has something mm-hmm. that she's trying to deal with it. She writes it down and then throws it away.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and some people are more verbal, and sometimes, you know, we encourage people to draw a picture of what's going on in your life.
Mm.
And often, you know, Carl Jung was really a proponent of mandalas. And often, you know, if you, you know, it helps that kind of controlling part of the mind to quiet down a little bit, and you'll see things coming out of you that you weren't even that aware of. It gives you insight and makes those connections and brings meaning and also solutions. It's funny, I was meeting with this beautiful psychologist named Robert Johnson. Do you know him? He wrote these amazing books called We, He, She, Ecstasy. He's in his late 80s now. He's the last living psychologist who actually studied with Carl Jung in person. So he's a beautiful man, very wise, very much about mythology and how it affects psychology. So I was telling him about my book, and he said, oh, Dr. Jung would like that book, because Dr. Jung used to say that your dream is your prescription. And it's really this beautiful insight that everybody carries within them what they really want and what they really need that will make them happy and healthy. But often we keep it all buried up, and I think whenever we can access that deeper dream, not just when we're sleeping, but even when we're awake, it's really the course to healing and transformation.
David, would you like to read a section from Free to Love, Free to Heal for our listeners today?
Sure. Do you have anything in mind, or should I just pick something?
You just pick something. This is Dr. David Simon.
Why don't I just read from the introduction?
Perfect.
So tell me when to stop.
Okay.
In my role as a mind-body physician, I hear many heart-rending tales. Over the 3 decades I've been practicing medicine, I've come to see a person's migraines, fatigue, digestive distress, or back pain as a kind of admission pass that entitles the bearer to a few moments of a doctor's attention. And after listening to people's problems for so many years, I've learned that when I can create enough safety for the sufferer, an underlying story, a story that at its heart is about giving or receiving love, will be revealed to me. And if I, as a doctor, can hoax the hidden meaning of the illness into the open, then healing can begin. And, you know, actually that reminds me of, I'm sure you know Michael Crichton, you know, the great novelist.
Right.
And his first book was a book called Travels. And he wrote this actually while he was a medical student at Harvard. And he was assigned to the coronary care unit. And apparently it was a kind of a quiet night, but he was in the hospital, so he decided that he would just start talking to patients who were there with recent heart attacks. Mm-hmm. And he asked them a simple question, why do you think you got a heart attack? And what he found was that not a single person said, I had a heart attack because my LDL cholesterol was too high, or because I was smoking one, you know, pack of cigarettes a day, or because I had a family history of heart disease. Everybody had a story. Wow. And everybody's story who had a heart attack had something to do with their emotional heart. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. someone that they loved died, their spouses, you know, divorced them or left them, they weren't appreciated at work. And that emotional heart story in their own minds translated into a physical broken heart, you know, a heart attack. And that has resonated with me for decades. And you know, my work now is really demonstrating that it's true for so many people, that and that people are afraid to or have never had the opportunity to really reveal that story. Wow. But finding people that you can tell that story to who will listen compassionately, you know, is a really powerful healing response.
You want to go on and read a little more?
Sure. Let me just open up a page and get to something that. Actually, let me go to the last page. It's funny when I do book signings.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to skip to the last part because I think people who are not ready to do the deeper work may resonate with that more.
Ah.
Then when I talk about what I think is important to create these really loving, nurturing relationships, then people usually are willing to start talking about what's getting in the way of that.
Mm.
So here, let me read you from Chapter 10, Writing a Great Love Story. I quote Hafiz, one of the great Sufi poets, you know, says, ever since happiness heard your name, it's been running through the streets trying to find you.
Oh, I love that.
Chapter starts, congratulations on reaching this point. Assuming you didn't skip the previous 9 chapters and have performed the exercises, you are not the same person you were when you picked up this book. You've identified emotional residue from your past and brought it into your conscious awareness, where you've separated the emotional charge from the facts of the experience. Through the recognition that people are doing their best from their level of awareness, you have substantially relinquished your feelings of regret, resentment, and guilt, replacing them with understanding and forgiveness. You are now committed to practicing conscious communication so that you can approach your relationships with the skills to identify and convey your needs in ways that enhance the likelihood that they will be met. The question now is, what story do you want to see unfolding from this point forward? You have the opportunity and responsibility to create an authentic life, one in which you are the writer, director, and lead actor, rather than a bit player in someone else's tale. Everyone enjoys an epic story, which is why we tell them over and over. Look what's playing now at your local movie theater. Most storylines are either about good triumphing over evil or love prevailing over estrangement. A heroic figure, despite all odds, is able to overcome destructive forces and reestablish justice, fairness, and harmony in the world. Lovers who are pulled apart find their way back into each other's hearts. These are the perennial tales that we've been telling each other since the beginning of humankind. Should I keep going?
Yeah, a couple minutes.
Okay. You are powerful, intelligent, and interesting. You are complicated and valuable. You are attractive. You are a good person. You are worthy of love. You are deserving of happiness. My hope is that you can embrace these truths more readily now than when you started this book. Say them to yourself and see if you can embody the essence of this recognition without real or feigned modesty, without self-pity or self-importance. You have these lovable qualities and more because you are living the gift of a human incarnation and have this rare opportunity to be a conscious manifestation of the universe. Your individuality is a wave on the ocean of universality. Even as each wave expresses its unique qualities and talents, it retains its essential oceanic nature. To use another metaphor, gold can be made into bracelets, charms, and coins, but its eternal goldenness cannot be destroyed. You are the universe playing hide-and-seek with itself. You are the sacred in disguise. You are God in drag. Knowing this, you can no longer feel sorry for yourself because your heart and soul retain the memory of your essential divinity. With this awareness, you have the capacity to create a compelling life story, a story in which you are free to love and which you love freely.
Thank you, David. That was Dr. David Simon reading from Free to Love, Free to Heal. And this book is available wherever books are sold, I assume.
Right.
Yeah. And where can people find out more about you and about the work of the Chopra Center?
So we actually have a dedicated website, which is freetolove.com, and that has like extra chapters and exercises and blogs and lots of fun things going on. And then that links to our larger website, which is chopra.com. So that for people who are interested, it talks about all the other seminars, programs, workshops, certification courses that we have available. And you can sign up for our free newsletter, which is called Agni, on those sites, so that, you know, twice a month we send out some messages that we hope are inspiring and letting people know what else is going on at the Chopra Center.
Now, David, when did this book come out?
Came out a couple months ago.
And what kind of response have you gotten to the book so far?
Critical response has been really, phenomenal. It's a pretty deep conversation, so I don't think that the popular press has yet quite figured out what to do with it. There's been interest shown in it by a lot of the national talk shows, but none have invited me to talk about it yet. I think, there's a certain kind of reservation. It doesn't fit that quickly into 3-second sound bites.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
It's selling very well. It hit about number 30 on Amazon.com, after it was first released. And, what we hear more than anything is people are sharing it with people that they care about. So they'll get a copy for themselves, and then pretty soon they're buying copies for their family members and their loved ones. So everybody who comes to our course comes away saying that they know like 5 or 10 people that they think would really benefit. So that's our expectation, that just by word of mouth, it'll continue to people's minds and hearts.
It's true that it is a deep conversation, but it's also very accessible. The writing style is very...
Easy to read.
It's very easy to read.
Right.
You're not, like you said, you're not assuming a certain knowledge beforehand, so I think anyone who picks up this book can understand what you're trying to say.
You're not preaching to them. I think the bottom line is...
I really, it's what I do every day.
Yeah, and, you should be good at it right now, right?
And I want people to embrace, you know, their human life. It's so short that to spend it, a good part of it, you know, wallowing in unnecessary struggle and suffering and the regret, you know, it's just, you know, there's a joke that I tell at courses where... you know, people go to a restaurant, they order their food, they eat it for a little while, and then one of them starts complaining that it's not very good, and the other one starts complaining that the portions are too small. Fortunately, a lot of people live their life their way. You know, they're unhappy, but they're so afraid that they're going to die. And, you know, we want to go to a different restaurant where we're really embracing what an amazing gift having a human experience is.
I have known people that are not happy unless they're unhappy, you know.
Yeah,
that seems to be. But I think the bottom line is you're showing people how to love themselves, right?
Yeah, absolutely, because we all deserve it. You know, it's like we're often so compassionate towards other people's stories, and yet we carry this burden of regret or undeserving with us, and it really translates. I mean, I big issue. Obviously, everyone's paying attention to healthcare these days, but you know, if you look at the role of obesity on health, it's profound. You know, its effects, it's such a risk factor for everything from diabetes to heart disease to cancer to chronic pain. You know, but really, why do people have such an issue with food? It's because we learned early on that if you weren't getting enough love, maybe you could get a bottle. You know, you could feed yourself, and you know, we find that when people realize that they are lovable, that, you know, that it's so easy for them to drop off the extra weight and start taking better care of themselves, and it translates into real, genuine changes in their physical health as well as their emotional well-being. So I just think we have to bring this into the conversation. I think I mentioned I met with this group of orthopedists recently who you know, have been treating backs for years, and you know, they just say, you know, nobody ever talks about people's stresses or people, you know, how their relationships are going, and we know that it has a profound effect on back pain, but you know, when anti-inflammatories don't work and physical therapy doesn't work, they'll literally go to the extent of doing surgery rather than the willingness to say, you know, maybe there's something happening in your marriage or in your work that's not serving you. And it's only when someone has failed these, you know, these intense measures that then the conversation about the emotional component comes up. So I think we've got the cart before the horse here, and if we just start to realize that we're all in it together, you know, I think we can improve the happiness and health of our society, of our communities.
Now, David, how many books have you published altogether?
This is my 13th book, actually.
Oh,
13th.
My goodness.
Wow.
Oh, my
Did you
goodness.
Always want to be a writer?
No, I never wanted to be a writer.
So how did you end up being a writer?
Well, you have to, he has to share this knowledge. I mean,
well, you know, the first book I wrote was called The Wisdom of Healing. And, you know, that's, you know, this was, 18 years ago, Deepak, you know, and I started the program, and we started teaching mind-body medicine courses, and we didn't really have a syllabus, so I started writing the syllabus, and then I realized that the syllabus could easily become kind of a little accessible textbook on mind-body medicine. And I realized that as I was writing, I was learning a lot of things. I mean, you know, not only in terms of the research, but I found that for me, writing allowed me to access kind of a deeper level of my psyche that integrated principles that weren't so obvious to me, you know, when I was just in my usual state. And so I found that by me writing something that seemed like I was an expert, I was actually learning more than probably anybody who read my work.
Wow. Well, we're out of time now, but I'd love to have another conversation with you just about how you've developed as a writer. That would be fascinating,
correct,
too.
Yes.
And thank you so
probably
much.
Be a shorter conversation.
Well, thank you so much for this book and for being on Writer's Voices.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
It was wonderful. Mm. And next up, we have Planet Erstwhile with James Moore at 2 o'clock He's interviewing the legendary singer-songwriter Donovan, talking about his life, his music, and his upcoming visit to Fairfield and the concert at the Sondheim Center for the 4th Annual David Lynch Weekend, November 13th to 15th. At 3 p.m., James speaks with Laura Dawn of the Age of Enlightenment, who's also part of the Lynch Weekend extravaganza. The Little Death will perform as well, a band that she fronts, which was started by Moby. And then at 4 p.m., Pontus J. Back, Finnish former hard rock star, talks about his music and conversion from drugs and alcohol to evangelist for the Gospels. He's in town performing a number of concerts in the area over the next few days.
Oh, my goodness. Packed full.
Packed full. So stay tuned for that, and we will close with a quote from Mom.
This is perfect. I just chose this today. No matter what happened in the past, the future is spotless.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.